Hello, welcome to Literally from the North Shore, and thanks for tuning in. Today we are listening to Sins of Our Fathers, a novel by Sean Lawrence Otto, published in 2014 by Milkweed Editions. The audiobook version is broadcast with permission from Blackstone Audio.
He pressed his fingertips to the paperwork on top. A pale blue report card. Jacob Eagle, McGizzy Dudem, C's and D's, B plus in math. Teacher comments to the right of each grade, able but distracted, not engaged, disruptive in class. The bookcase was filled with books about Native Americans, as well as DVDs of Avatar, Dances with Wolves, Smoke Signals, Babel, Crash, and The Visitor. A small stack of CDs, Jim Boyd, Bob Marley, Jana, and videos of powwows. There was also a brass eagle in flight, which J.W. took to be an eponymous testament to the man's inflated self-image. He opened the center drawer. Pens and pencils, ink cartridges, a calculator. A self-help book, Fearless Living, Live Without Excuses and Love Without Regret, suggested a kind of touchy-feely vulnerability that both moved and repelled J.W. He took the bug from his pocket, wiped it clean, and placed it in the back of the drawer. He shut the drawer and glanced out the window. The coast was still clear. Down the hill he could see his own trailer, a dirty blue robin's egg in the fine wavy grass under the oak trees. He pulled open the desk's file drawer, again using his shirt cuff to avoid leaving any fingerprints. Neatly ordered files. He squatted and rifled through the brown tabs. They emitted a rich aroma of cigar smoke. One of the folders said, Nature's Bank. He opened it and examined the contents. Motes of dust lifted off the papers like tiny hot air balloons sparkling in the sun. He glanced out the window. The longer he stayed, the greater his chances of being caught. But this might be the mother lode. He scanned a page with numbers. Startup capitalization, $3.5 million. He closed the folder and slipped it back into the file drawer. He'd had enough. It was obviously a bank, and he was increasingly nervous. Someone could come home at any time, Eagle, the boy, or someone else. He pushed the drawer shut and glanced out the window again. He crossed to the door. But something caught his eye and he stopped. He went to the closet's bifold door and pulled it open. Inside was a safe. He crouched and tried the handle, but it was locked. The dial had numbers, every 10 marks to 100. He tried turning it to see if it was just slightly off, but it didn't open. He stood, glanced at the closet shelves, office supplies, paper, a yellow box of trash can liners. He closed the closet door and returned to the hallway, using his shirt cuff to pull the door shut like it had been. He tiptoed quickly back down the hall and crossed to the door. He opened it a crack and looked out. The coast seemed clear. He exited into the open air of the shaded porch and eased the door shut, then gently let the screen door close. The fresh air hit him like a gasp of relief. He stepped off the front deck and glanced at the white brick house up the road, and as he turned, he saw a curtain falling back into place in a high corner window. His heart leaped in his chest. Surely whoever lived in the house knew Eagle, and would relay the story of how the white guy in the trailer had broken into his house while he was away. He had to do something. Pretending it hadn't happened was not an option. Perhaps he could still avert a catastrophe by going up and talking to whomever had been behind that curtain. He looked both ways and then walked out into Eagle's yard, consciously adopting an aw shucks kind of amble in his gait. He began formulating a plan. He was out looking to borrow some sugar. He wanted directions to the trading post. A dozen clichés came to mind, none of them compelling. He crossed the driveway in front of the brick house's tuck-under garage and mounted the concrete steps leading up to the front door. It was somehow even hotter up there in the sun. The white blazed everywhere, making him feel as if he were in a solar cooker. He glanced at the tall casement windows. They all had white curtains, and he couldn't see beyond them. He would improvise. Eagle's front door was set in a few feet, and he saw that it was out of view. He was just standing on the porch, he would say, making a phone call. He had wanted to greet his neighbors. What could be wrong with that? He stepped up onto the front porch. The windows in the front of the house were all closed, but they felt watchful. He looked around in vain for a doorbell. He tried the white metal storm door, but it was locked tight. A Baltimore Oriole swooped in and fluttered near a hanging feeder heaped with grape jelly, but, seeing him, thought better of it and flitted away. He heard something crash deep inside the house. He knocked, but there was no response. "Hello," he called. Still nothing. Now what? He stood in the blazing sun, contemplating his options. A trickle of sweat ran down between his shoulder blades. Whoever was in there had probably seen him. Perhaps they were calling the police. Or going for a shotgun. J.W. decided to head back to his trailer. That way, at least, he would have some deniability if the police did come. He could argue that the other person was crazy, or just making things up, and that they were probably overly suspicious just because he was white. He stepped off the stoop and walked back down the steps, glancing back at the home's mute windows. He thought he saw a shadow move behind a curtain. He stopped, but nothing more happened. He wondered if this was all just his imagination. He felt sullied by what he had just done, but a job was a job. He headed out the driveway and across the street, glancing back to see if he could catch anyone watching, but there was no sign of life. It suddenly occurred to him that he was a criminal now. Not technically, he reassured himself. He hadn't stolen anything. You leave your door open and sometimes neighbors wander in. That's what happens out in the country. He turned toward his trailer home, sure that he could sense someone watching him. Chapter 9. The sun had moved to the northwest, and the trees no longer shaded the front half of the trailer. The metal handle was hot in his hand as he pulled the flimsy aluminum door open. It had expanded in the heat, and the bottom stuck in the frame, then sprang outward with a rattling shudder. He stepped inside. The air was spicy hot and still. He closed the door and listened to the fine ticks of the trailer's metal exterior shifting in the heat. There was no air conditioner, so he went around opening all the windows. This must be why the screens were so well maintained, he realized. He finished with the roof vent over the galley kitchen, and then the windows in the front end around the table. A cross breeze lifted up, and he sat down on the bench, where he had a view of the white brick house through a gap in the trees. He focused a pair of binoculars on the curtained windows. They gleamed back at him in mute judgment. J.W. lowered the binoculars and began formulating plausible excuses. He hadn't actually gone into Eagle's house. He had stood for some time at the door, out of view of the White House, waiting for his neighbor to return, hoping to introduce himself. You need to know your neighbors, after all. Since no one was home, he decided to say hello to his other neighbor. No answer there either, so he walked back home. Anything else was simply the result of an overly suspicious imagination, a misunderstanding. A deep rolling build of thunder signaled a storm brewing off to the west. Here on the edge of the prairie, large anvil clouds often billowed up on hot afternoons. One could stand in the blazing sun and watch them, 10 or 15 miles distant, blue-gray rain angling down, stabs of lightning flashing inside. But this one was still a ways off, and there was no coolness or wind yet. The trees buzzed with a cacophony of insects. There was nothing to do but wait. As the minutes ticked by and nothing happened, the warmth of the trailer grew more stifling. He put his face up to a window for some fresh air. The police still hadn't come. J.W.'s shirt stuck to his skin, and a trickle of sweat ran down the edge of his neck. Maybe it would be all right. There'd been no phone calls, no neighbor coming out, no eagle, no police. Maybe the neighbor wouldn't even say anything. Or maybe he had imagined the whole thing. Then again, something had crashed inside, so it was likely a person. And if the neighbor did say something, he would have to deal with Eagle directly. J.W. imagined him coming over with a baseball bat, or possibly even a gun. He wondered how the laws differed on a reservation, and that thought suddenly seemed to ground his thinking. He was a bank president. What he had done was crazy. He had risked everything. His eyes fell to the big book. He pulled it over across the table and started leafing through it. Maybe there was something to it. A sickness was clouding his judgment, and Jorgensen had used it to make him into a tool. And yet he couldn't see a way out of the trap. And it was hard to imagine finding one in the book. It was approaching 5 o'clock and nothing had happened. The road had been unusually quiet. A single small blue Toyota with a red front fender had puttered by, slowly climbing up the lane to the trailers over the hill. Even the boy hadn't come home at his usual time. J.W. was getting hungry. He headed over to the stove. He rummaged through the cabinet above and took down a battered aluminum pot and a box of mac and cheese. He ran the tap and filled the pot halfway up, then struck a farmer's match and lit the stove. He set the pot over the flame, and when crystal bubbles began to rise from its bottom, he poured in the pale tubes of dried pasta. He looked out the window over the kitchen sink. Still nothing up at the neighbor's house, but to his right, he suddenly noticed a police car creeping up the road. It slowed almost to a stop, and then, as if to surprise him, it turned sharply in and parked directly in front of his trailer. J.W. ducked back away from the window, his heart suddenly racing. He wondered if he, too, could pretend he wasn't at home. The car's door slammed, and he peeked out to see a tribal policeman walking around the hood. He heard the creak of the wooden steps, and then a hard knock on his flimsy door. He leaned on the counter, thinking over his options. How stupid he'd been. What was he thinking? Was this it? Would he be arrested? The knock came again. He realized that the bug receiver was still on the table. "Just a second," he called out. He took the receiver to the bedroom and threw it under some clothes in the laundry hamper. He swallowed and wiped his hands on his pants. Noticed his dirty shirt cuff. He rolled up his sleeves and went to the door. There was nothing else to do. His lips felt numb. "This is the way people's lives change," he thought, "in quiet little moments, and there's no going back." His stomach felt jittery. He shook out his hands to get the rubberiness out. Tried to seem calm and cool. Don't assume he knows anything, or what he may or may not know. Don't incriminate yourself. He opened the door. The tribal cop was standing on the top stair, which put him a step lower than J.W. He had to shuffle sideways to avoid the outswinging door. "Yes, sir, can I help you?" said J.W. "Mr. White?" "Yes." Through the fog of fear, J.W. noticed that the man had an expectant smile. He was waiting. For what? A confession? Maybe to see if he would give something away. J.W. had heard that most one-time criminals admit their crime almost immediately when confronted by the authorities. He wasn't going to be one of them. "You don't remember me," the cop said. "Rick Flatabow. Used to work security at the bank." "Rick! Sorry. Of course," replied J.W. "Jesus," he thought. "Flatabow. security guard. You look different in that tribal getup. J.W. knew as soon as he said it that it was offensive, but he desperately wanted to keep the upper hand, so he didn't apologize. He smiled.
Yeah, well, I heard you were staying out here now. Figured I'd stop by and say hi. Welcome to the reservation and all.
Well, thanks, Rick, replied J.W. noncommittally. I appreciate that. He saw Flatabow notice that he was sweating.
You doing okay?
J.W. nodded. Just hot in here. No A.C. You want to come in for a sauna? Flatabow laughed.
No thanks. Say, I heard what happened about you losing your job and so on.
Rick, I've got some stuff on the stove.
I know. I don't want to take your time. Just to say, listen, if you ever want, the tribe's got a gambling and addictions support group. A real nice one. We got top people, trained at UMD, the whole works. It's one of our mandates for having the casino. We don't want anybody to get hurt.
He handed J.W. a business card. It bore a colorful round tribal logo, the name of the group, the Bizana Waywind support group, and a phone number and web URL.
It's a funny-sounding name, Bizana Waywind, offered Flatabow. Means peace.
J.W. looked down at the card. His brow creased as he looked up from it. He felt his pulse in a vein on his neck. He wondered how word of his situation had traveled so quickly, and whether Flatabow was acting individually, or if this was a visit some band committee had asked him to make.
Anyway, welcome.
Flatabow gave him a curt little nod and a wave, then turned and walked back to his cruiser. Rick! J.W. called out after him. Flatabow stopped and looked back. Thanks. Flatabow waved. As he got in his car, J.W. noticed for the first time that someone was sitting in the back seat. The car backed out onto the road and stopped in front of Eagle's house. Flatabow got out and opened the back door. The boy from across the street climbed out and sloughed off toward the pole barn without so much as a word to Flatabow, who saw J.W. still standing in the door and waved before getting back into his car. He had kept the kid waiting that whole time. J.W. waved back, then pulled the door shut and returned to his macaroni. He stirred it weakly, recovering from the adrenaline rush. He glanced at the business card in his left hand. Peace. The tiny crescents swam like blind fish in the roiling water. He went to the fridge and pulled out the Red Owl carton of milk. As he turned, he glanced out the window. The boy was tugging on a red lead rope, trying to drag the horse across the lawn toward the riding ring. The animal was ignoring him again. It grazed on the lawn, planting its feet against the lead rope. J.W. noticed how tightly wound the boy seemed. He was probably recovering from his own adrenaline rush after getting a lift home from Flatabow. His teenage frustration wafted across the road. Come on! The horse ignored him. Then finally, begrudgingly, it lifted its head and half-heartedly let the boy lead it away from the grass. The boy dragged the horse over to the riding paddock gate, unlatched it, and swung it open. He pulled with first one, then two hands, but the horse stood still, feet planted, head high, refusing to go in. J.W. moved to the window, watching this little drama. Horse training was all about convincing a horse that what you wanted was what it wanted too, only more so. And J.W. could see that the kid had no idea what he was doing. Come on! Come on! The boy pulled hard on the lead rope, stretching the horse's neck out, but the animal's feet were firm. He stormed up beside it, and the horse responded by stepping backward. The boy stumbled as he tried to stay on his feet. J.W. heard the horse snorting. No! The boy yelled. He punched the horse on the side of the neck. It threw its head and pulled hard backward, squatting on its haunches as it prepared to rear. It stood, which dragged the boy up off the ground and into its dancing front hooves.
"Hey!"
he yelled at the window. Stupid kid, he thought. The rearing horse's head could come down and break his neck, and it would trample him if it ran forward. The boy twisted to miss the hooves and scrambled to the right, along the horse's front left flank. "He's quick, I'll give him that," thought J.W. Then the boy wrapped the lead rope around his wrist and kicked the horse hard in its soft underbelly. The horse screamed with a high, frightened sound and tried to spin away, but the boy had leverage with the lead rope, so it reared and pulled him right back into the range of its hooves. This time the boy couldn't find his footing. Before he knew it, J.W. was out the trailer door and running. The horse twisted and landed and galloped off across the lawn, dragging the boy close to its thundering hooves.
"Pride!"
the boy yelled as he bumped along over the ground.
"Pride! No!"
His voice sounded screechy with fear.
"Let it go!"
J.W. yelled as he ran after them. The boy took a hard bump on a root and let go, and the horse galloped off. He lay on his stomach, the wind knocked out of him, his cheeks pressed into the grass. The horse slowed to a trot and began to circle in the yard. Then it stopped at a safe distance and snorted and pawed at the lawn.
"You okay?"
J.W. asked as he ran up. The boy was wheezing for breath and wincing back tears. He slowly got to his hands and knees. Then, ignoring J.W., he headed shakily after the horse.
"Hey!"
The kid spun around.
"I got it!"
he yelled, then fell into a coughing fit. He was wearing jeans and a baggy Twins jersey.
"Okay, nice to meet you," said J.W. "I'm your new neighbor, by the way. Why don't you let me help?"
The boy ignored him and turned back toward the horse, which trotted a few steps farther away. He stopped and stood, angry.
"You're chasing him off."
The boy's posture slumped, but he didn't turn around. He took another step toward the horse, but it jogged even farther away.
God!
J.W. glanced back toward the trailer home. The door was standing open. He looked down at the waxy milk carton in his hand.
"Hey, kid," he said, and began marching toward the boy's back. "I got something for you."
The boy turned around.
"Hold this,"
J.W. said, and shoved the milk carton into his hands. He turned toward Pride and gave him a snappy whistle. Pride snorted as he grazed, made a big sigh, then took a few steps toward the neighbor's house, still munching on the lawn.
"You're chasing him off, old school," said the boy.
J.W. turned, irritated.
"Go over there," he said, and pointed toward the house. "So you're not between him and the gate. Go on."
The boy didn't move.
"You want your horse back?"
J.W. looked at him, and he looked back.
"I did this for a living," said J.W.
The boy shook his head and walked across the yard to where J.W. had indicated. When he was a safe distance off, J.W. nodded.
"Okay."
He looked down at the ground, hands in his pockets. He jangled his keys and assumed a relaxed air. Not a care in the world. Just him and the horse, together and alone in a herd of two. It was like a mantra. It all came back as if it had been yesterday. If he got his mind in the right space, J.W. knew the horse would follow. He started whistling softly, "You Are My Sunshine," and he grazed with his feet, swinging and poking them at the grass. He walked wide around the horse, not paying it any attention, not getting too close, just focused on the grass. "I'm just doing my thing here. Just leave me alone and I'll leave you alone," he thought, walking and whistling. Pride's ears followed him like radar dishes. He stopped about 15 or 20 feet behind the horse, between him and the house. Pride grazed, flipping his ears around, flapping his tail to scare off the flies. But J.W. could see from the tension in the horse's muscles that he was ready to leap, turn, and trot off down the road at a moment's notice. He stopped whistling and looked up. at Pride's chest, not his eyes. The horse snorted long and low as he grazed, a dramatic, put-upon snort. J.W. took a big step toward his rear end and lifted up his arm toward him, as if he were reaching for his tail. Pride lifted his head and trotted 8 or 9 steps toward the gate, then went back to grazing, with a frisky air about him, light on his feet. J.W. noticed the boy was studying his moves intently. He felt a sudden affection for him, rude and surly as he was. J.W. kept looking at the grass and whistling. He strolled wide and away and then angled back, stopping behind and to the side again, but closer. Then he took his hands out of his pockets. He kept whistling, and he walked slowly, eyes averted, toward Pride's side. The horse's ears flicked around as he grazed, but he stayed where he was. The boy watched him, his arms crossed and a scowl on his face. J.W. reached out and petted the base of the horse's sweaty neck. Gentle. Relaxed. No reason to hurry. Just the two of them grazing. Then he reached down and picked up the lead rope, but left it slack. They stood there, grazing, for another minute, the horse munching and J.W. poking the grass with his toe. He examined the rope in his left hand, pretending to be interested in its fine weave. Not a care in the world. Until he reached back wide with his right hand toward Pride's rear end and whistled sharply. Come on. Pride let out another long snort and then lifted his head. He walked next to J.W. on a slack rope, right up to the gate. The boy looked amazed. He began heading down toward the paddock. J.W. made a kissing sound at the horse and reached out toward his rear end again. Pride stepped into a trot and moved into the riding ring with his head high and an eye on J.W., but without any hesitation. J.W. tossed the lead rope over his neck as he went in and closed the gate behind him. Pride snorted and circled and came to a stop, watching him attentively as if waiting for the next order. It was the old magic. The boy looked down as J.W. turned to him. Can't fight nature, son. Got a sweet talker. He extended a hand to shake. John White, but my friends call me J.W. Good for you, the boy said, looking right at him but not offering his hand in return. J.W. snorted at the response. Give me my milk, you little punk, he said, and smiled. The boy held it out, but then began to turn the carton to pour it out. J.W. snatched it out of his hand. Thanks, he said. You got a weak hand there? Because it looked like you couldn't hold the milk up or something. He turned and walked back across the street, jangling his keys in his pocket.
You have been listening to Episode 7 of Sins of Our Fathers by Sean Lawrence Otto. The novel will be presented in a total of 23 episodes. If you miss any, you can catch up on our website, ktwh.org. Choose Programs and then Literally from the North Shore from the drop-down list. Please join us again next time for Episode 8 of Sins of Our Fathers, here on Literally from the North Shore.